Nobody knows what the term pop is. The term pop is to pop your nut, come in your pants.
Right.
You understand?
Yeah, yeah.
Have an orgasm.
Right.
How many do you have when you're fucking?
A zillion.
Yes, one.
Right.
Right?
Right.
Well, if they pop when you walk out through the entrance, turn around and go back in. You're done. Because after that, just like sticking your dick in a hole, it's nothing but wasted time and friction.
You're listening to The Sound Off. The Sound Off. With the Solomonster. Solomonster.
I think you're starting to believe in your own bullshit, Hogan. The party must be over. Patterson's here with Briscoe. What?
You need to hit them sit-ups, too. You're not exactly leanest. Forget seeing me, bro. You can't see your own penis. Woo!
Welcome to episode 142 of The Sound Off here on SEScoops.com. It is the Solomonster here with you on Sunday, January 16th, 2011. Thank you, as always, for downloading the podcast as we prepare for yet another winter storm here in New York. I think I've seen enough snow and ice this season to last me the next couple of years. So let's hope this one isn't too bad later in the week. But right now, sky is clear and got a lot of stuff to get to this week, more so than usual. A lot of topics to kind of jump around to, and some stuff I know you guys wanted me to touch on, so I'll have some comments about this and that. I want to start off with one of the bigger stories, if not the biggest story of the week, which some of you may disagree with, but that is Ring of Honor losing its TV deal with HDNet. Now, Ring of Honor first debuted on HDNet back in March of 2009, and over the last couple of years, it really hasn't even been that long, they've had a pretty good relationship with one another, but the thing about HDNet is it is a cable station that is not as widely available as a USA or a Spike TV or an MTV or stations like that that have had wrestling shows in the past. And in fact, HDNet no longer even bothers monitoring ratings for its broadcasts. So there's really been no way to determine how successful or not ROH on HDNet has been. Whether or not it's really had any impact at all on Ring of Honor's business and bottom line. Obviously, the penetration of the channel is not all that great. I don't think ROH has really noticed any significant change for the better or worse in their ticket sales, DVD sales, and things of that nature because of the HDNet relationship. But still, there's something to be said for having your own TV deal with a cable network. And the final tapings for the ROH on HDNet show are going to be taking place on the 20th and the 21st, so it's coming up later in the week, and they're going to be taping in Philadelphia. The TV show will air through April 4th, which is ironic because the week after that, and again, this is, I don't think one has anything at all to do with the other, but on April 4th, when the final ROH airs on HDNet, the following week is when WWE Tough Enough moves into its normal slot of 8 p.m., which is when Ring of Honor aired. So I guess in that respect, you kind of avoid there being a conflict on Monday nights between the two shows. Based on everything I've read and everything I've seen and the statement released by Ring of Honor, it is an amicable parting of the ways. There's no bad blood. Nobody hates the other. I think ROH did pay, HDNet paid ROH a fee, a license fee for the show. So that's one, I suppose, source of revenue that the company is going to miss out on. But Ring of Honor is operating on the assumption that it's business as usual. You know, all it is the lack of a TV show. They're going to continue to run shows like they have been. They have their internet pay-per-views every couple of months, which have seen an exponential increase in the number of buys. You know, there's the talk of perhaps ROH and HDNet doing something together, maybe in the vein of live specials a couple of times during the year. But as far as I know, those were just preliminary talks they were having before the announcement was made that they, in fact, would not be renewing the two-year deal, which I guess does run through the beginning of April. And Ring of Honor is looking for another TV outlet. You know, good luck to them on that. It's not an easy thing to do to find a television station willing to put on a wrestling show. And one thing that I saw people doing online, and I made a comment about this as well on my Facebook page earlier in the week, and it's never going to happen. In reality, this is just a far-fetched fantasy scenario. But nonetheless, people wondering if perhaps we could petition Spike TV to replace TNA wrestling with ROH wrestling. And like I said, it's a pipe dream. It's not going to happen. But I'll be honest with you, it's something I wouldn't mind. Even if it was just a 1 week or 2 week experiment where TNA took a break, which they could probably use, and Ring of Honor was put on in their place. Now, you know, ROH is not everyone's cup of tea. Ring of Honor is a promotion that is known for its in-ring work and, in many ways, old-school wrestling mentality. So, for example, on the HDNet show, you would see a lot of jobber matches, you know, like you would see in some of the 80s WWF programming. But when it came to their top stars and their main events, there's hardly any matches in WWE or TNA that could hold a candle to the best ROH matches. And that's really what they became known for. And that's not going to satisfy everybody. Some people want their sports entertainment mixed in with pro wrestling, which is not to say that ROH is just wrestling and nothing more. That would be a lie. The one thing I regret is I don't have HDNet available through Cablevision here in New York. And I believe HDNet only recently became available on Time Warner, which is actually the biggest cable company in New York, and so by virtue of one of the bigger cable companies in the entire country. HDNet is just not that widely available. So the only exposure I personally have had to their TV show has been through clips and whatnot on YouTube. So it's hard for me to fully judge. But the show had a lot of fans. Recently on SC Scoops, I started posting quick results to the ROH shows, in part because there was a pent-up demand for more ROH coverage on the website, which there will be. That's not going to stop. But it's just kind of a shame that the show now is kind of on its last legs. And here's hoping they find a new TV outlet. At the end of the day, the promotion lives and dies by the checkbook of Cary Silkin. He's the one who has been financing this outfit from the very beginning. And if the day comes that Cary says, you know what, I'm losing money or I don't want to do this anymore, that and not HDNet or any other TV station will be the final nail in the coffin for Ring of Honor. So it's business as usual. You know, the promotion is not going anywhere, but the TV show will cease to exist as of the night after WrestleMania. Some thoughts from Raw this past Monday night. An interesting show, and a show that, and don't take this the wrong way, but a show that reminded me in some ways of the edgier days of WWE and the Attitude Era. And what I mean by that is all the stuff with CM Punk being on top of the Titantron. I can't remember anybody being on top of the Titantron like that since probably when Hawk got pushed off by Draws, which was probably back in like 97, 98. 98 it would have been. That was when Hawk was doing the gimmick where he was drunk and was pushed off, or was he intentionally pushed off the Titantron by Draws, who was a member of the LOD 2000 troupe at the time. I know that Jeff Hardy and people like that have done stunts off the Titantron, but that was from I think the metal portion of the Tron at its bottom. I don't remember there being anybody being on the very top of the Titantron since the late 90s, but I could be wrong. In any event, I certainly wouldn't want to be all the way up there. Let's put it that way. CM Punk went up there. The theme of the show was this. The theme of the show was CM Punk is now officially the new leader of Nexus. And he was going to initiate each member of Nexus essentially back into the group to prove who truly wanted to be part of Nexus and who didn't really necessarily have it in them to be part of the faction. And pretty much everybody passed their initiation. Justin Gabriel and Heath Slater were the only two who refused their initiation when CM Punk each handed them a kendo stick and asked them to basically beat the shit out of each other. They refused and walked off, and we'll get to them in a little bit when we talk about SmackDown. But, you know, you had Michael McGillicuddy accepting a beatdown, essentially, from all the members of Nexus to start the show. You have Husky Harris, who is willingly taking lashes from a leather belt from the members of Nexus. CM Punk just strapped the shit out of this poor guy. And I will say one thing, and I made a comment on Twitter about this, about that scene with whipping Husky. I made a comment that and I have to go back and find the tweet, that it's a good thing my girlfriend wasn't watching this show at the time, because God knows what she would have thought. I think we all know what she would have thought about that scene. I mean, here's a group of guys, you know, half naked. Punk was the only one wearing pants. And they're backstage with this guy that calls himself Husky Harris, and they're whipping each other with leather belts. It sounds a little off. And, you know, thank God she wasn't watching. Well, last night, you know, we were together, and WWE, I had forgotten, has that AM Raw show, which is essentially a one-hour clipped version of Raw that airs at 2 a.m. here on the East Coast on USA. And sure enough, you know, after a while, we put the TV back on, and there was AM Raw. She flipped right by it, and she said, okay, we'll watch this for a little bit. And sure as shit, she put the show on right at the exact moment that Punk was handing out the leather straps to the members of Nexus, and like clockwork, within a matter of seconds, came the comment that this looks kind of gay. And who was I to disagree, because it did look kind of gay. But Husky passed his initiation. David Otunga had, well, he had the crap kicked out of him by the Big Show. And so Punk is on top of the Titantron later in the show, and he's basically saying he's going to dive off to his death as a way to sacrifice himself for the better good of Nexus. And, you know, nobody in the world believed that it would actually happen. I thought that maybe Cena was going to come out and push him off. That did not happen. Instead, Punk basically just said, you're all sheep for believing that I was going to jump off, even though nobody did. Nexus was in the ring, John Cena was up on the Titantron, and Cena cut a promo that, again, showed the Jekyll and Hyde side of him. He starts this promo out with that smirk on his face, cracking jokes and being humorous, although it was less comedy than normal. But still, he starts with comedy. And then at some point, it's like a switch goes on. And all of a sudden, he goes way over the top and gets all serious. And I think, you know, he took it a little over the top, but I think we need more of that. You know, Cena has not had a very lucky couple of months in WWE. He hasn't been champion for a long, long time. The Nexus attacks on him have been going on since June. He was quote-unquote fired from the company. He hasn't had the best half year or so in WWE. But yet, here's this guy coming out every single week with a giant smile on his face. I wish I could have this guy's optimism. So here he finally snaps. He's telling CM Punk that next week he gets dealt with. You know, as sure as I wear purple and the sun rises in the east, next week you get dealt with, after Punk accepted his invitation to a one-on-one match on Raw this coming Monday night, which I would have to hope will end briefly in somewhat of a schmoz if it happens at all, because, again, it would be foolish to give that match away on Raw. And then at the end of the promo, Cena basically says, next week you're going to get your ass whooped. And the place, you know, went crazy. And the internet just went into a tizzy fit because, oh my God, Cena said the word ass on TV. Now, for those of you who have asked, this whole thing about Cena getting fined, you know, Cena went on Twitter a day or two later and said that, you know, he apologized for his language. And he said that he was fined by WWE for using the word ass on TV. And everybody was all up in arms about this. Oh, WWE's so stupid. This PG crap has to go. How could they fine him for this? Listen, people. And there was one reputable website that actually reported that from their sources, as best as they could tell, Cena really did get fined. Let me tell you something right now. John Cena did not get fined, okay? We can all calm down. Most of the time when Cena's on his Twitter, he goes in and out of kayfabe. He's very much like Dixie Carter, only, you know, he's successful and he's actually made money. Take everything he says on there with a grain of salt. John Cena did not get fined. He did not say that word on his own, okay? Nothing that John Cena does in his promos these days is done off the cuff or on his own. I mean, if you just look at the promo itself, the way that whole promo was laid out, with Cena walking off at the end, it made perfect sense that he was going to say that and then walk off and leave this impression on people. There's no way he got fined for this, okay? And I want to go on the subject of PG here. I want to give a shout out to Tim Hellenhaus, one of our listeners and followers of mine on Facebook, who there was some kind of thread on my Facebook page about PG against TV-14 and all this bullshit. And I thought Tim nailed it. And I'm just going to read his comment that he posted on Facebook because I think this really says a lot. His comment was, and I quote, "I always hear people complain about PG, but you don't hear how awesome TNA is for being TV-14. That's because the ratings do not determine how good a wrestling program is. The answer is creativity, which most of the time both companies seem to have very little of. I thought that comment nailed it exactly. TNA, we oftentimes may forget, is in fact a TV-14 product. And I don't know anybody that would come on here and admit that TNA is a much better product than WWE. I've said before that I think top to bottom, TNA's overall talent roster is probably leaps and bounds better than WWE. But it doesn't matter because the way TNA books them and books their TV show, you never get to see that. And TV 14, as it may be, TNA is not leaps and bounds better than any other wrestling organization right now. And in fact, their TV show is the most frustrating wrestling TV show I think I've ever seen. So I thought that was a really, really key point to make, quite frankly, that all this talk about how PG has ruined WWE, and in many ways, it has not made the product better. Would I love to go back to an edgier product where people can say the word ass without, you know, getting fined or without people making a big deal out of it or, you know, certain angles and types of match stipulations that don't seem nearly as violent as they used to be? Would I like to go back to the way things were? In some respects, yes. In other respects, no. But all this talk about, you know, PG and this and that, it's a tired argument at this point. It's a tired argument at this point. I think Tim really nailed it with that comment, so I just wanted to give him a shout-out. The biggest story about Raw probably was the announcement of the first inductee into the WWE Hall of Fame class of 2011, which will, in fact, be the Heartbreak Kid, Shawn Michaels. When they were kind of hyping the announcement up earlier in the night and talking about the fact that this was going to be a huge name, one of the biggest names in the history of the business, you know, a lot of different names came to mind. I thought perhaps they had struck a deal with Sting to bring him in. And then I thought to myself, would they really refer to him this way, given that he never competed for their own organization and a lot of their own fans probably have no idea who Sting is or how big of a star he was in WCW? So my mind shifted away from Sting, and then I said, wait a minute. It could not possibly be, but could it be? Could it be the Macho Man, Randy Savage, who I am confident will go into the Hall of Fame one day because he just has to. Eventually, Vince McMahon is going to run out of names from the past to induct. And then I thought better of it. I kind of slapped myself in the face and said, yeah, okay, that's not going to happen. And during that last commercial break before the segment, I said to myself, Shawn Michaels. And sure as shit, it was Shawn Michaels. I figured they would maybe wait another year, but I guess they want to strike while the iron is hot. Michaels is still somewhat fresh in people's minds, and he certainly is a big star. He is the main event of this year's Hall of Fame class. I don't care who else they induct this year. If they bring in Sting, if they bring in Goldberg, it's not going to matter. Shawn Michaels is a far bigger star than either one of those guys and has had more of a lasting impact on his promotion than either one of those guys have had. So I can't think of a more deserving person, certainly, to go into the Hall of Fame than Shawn Michaels. Nobody will doubt his accomplishments in the business. Unless perhaps your name is Shane Helms. Now, I really didn't want to talk about this again, but I've had so many people email me about Shane Helms and Matt Hardy and Val Venus, so I'm just going to get this out of the way right now, because I don't want to spend too much time on any of these idiots anymore. And make no mistake, all of them are fucking morons. Shane Helms, Matt Hardy, Sean Morley, they're all a bunch of fucking morons. So Shane Helms goes on Twitter after the announcement is made about Shawn Michaels during Raw. And by the way, Helms announced this past week via his Twitter that he has signed a contract with Lucha Libre USA. So I guess he'll be on the next set of taping. So congratulations to him. He actually found work. So anyway, Helms goes on Twitter and makes, and again, just to give a little bit of background, if you missed the last podcast that I talked about this story, Shane Helms is not a fan of Shawn Michaels. Shane Helms has his own podcast called Highway to Helms each week, and several weeks ago he was asked a question, I believe, about who is the biggest star, the biggest idol of yours that when you met them they kind of let you down, and to the surprise of many, he mentioned the name Shawn Michaels, and he went on this diatribe about how Shawn was a piece of shit, he was a fake, he was a phony, he's not really a Christian, He's a, you know, a backstabber and a double crosser, and he gave him his props as an in-ring competitor, you know, and said he's one of the best in-ring performers of all time. But he told the story about one day at catering backstage, he saw Shawn Michaels yelling and being very disrespectful, against Chris Jericho for whatever reason. I don't know what the nature of that argument might have been, or if it even happened. I mean, I have no reason to think that Shane Helms would make up something like that. But anyway, that is the nature of his hatred. That's where it comes from. And he went on to make some other really stupid comments about how Shawn Michaels was the biggest coke user and steroid abuser in the history of the business, I think is what he said, or something to that effect. Now, I don't doubt for a second that Shawn Michaels probably was into coke and a whole lot of other shit in his career and did steroids. In fact, I think he got suspended for a failed steroid test back in 1993. That was when they took him off TV without him losing the Intercontinental title. But nonetheless, to call Shawn Michaels, considering all the roided-up monsters we've seen in this business over the years, the biggest steroid abuser ever, you kind of lose your credibility when you start making statements like that. So we already know Helms doesn't like Shawn Michaels, so he goes on Twitter and he makes the following comments. He says, "The Hall of Fame is great, but I take more pride and comfort in the fact that I've never screw-jobbed anyone in life or the business. Money is not everything." Another tweet, he says, "Flair got over people that absolutely sucked. Shawn hadn't gotten over anyone but himself in the last decade." He says, "Wearing a cross doesn't make you right. Hitler wore one too. Don't be fooled by a TV persona. I'm always honest. No one can accuse me." So let's just evaluate this here for a second. Basically, you have Shane Helms making an indirect comparison here of Shawn Michaels to Adolf Hitler. Yeah, that's not going over the top or anything. Yeah, of course not. Chris Jericho, for what it's worth, went on his own Twitter page after Raw Monday night and had nothing but glowing things to say about Shawn Michaels because he and Shawn are friends. They get along well. Chris idolized Shawn when he was growing up and getting into the business. He still maintains to this day that the match he had with Shawn at WrestleMania 19 is probably one of, if not the best match he ever had and his most thrilling moment. They had a great program over several months for the World Heavyweight title back in 2008. You may remember that whole angle at SummerSlam where Jericho popped Michaels' wife in the mouth, the whole thing. So Jericho goes on Twitter and he says, "Shawn Michaels was my favorite opponent and is the greatest performer of all time." That's what Chris Jericho said. Now, mind you, Shane Helms, his hatred for Shawn stems from this supposed backstage incident where Shawn yelled at Jericho in catering over something and was being very disrespectful towards him. So Jericho himself has not commented on this. And Jericho obviously either has forgiven and forgotten, if it ever happened in the first place, and he has nothing but glowing things to say about Shawn Michaels. So you would think, okay, well, he doesn't seem to have a problem with Shawn, so why should Shane Helms? Shane Helms actually retweeted Jericho's tweet and basically responded to Jericho and bashed him by saying, "Bullshit! Flair did more and got more people over." So now he's arguing with Chris Jericho here. The point of all this is this. Shane Helms has been unemployed and out of work for far too long. And when you're unemployed and you're out of work for far too long, normal people like you and I would attempt to look for work, okay, and we would go about our normal lives. But not Shane Helms. Oh no, Shane Helms must be into the ganja and everything else. He has gone cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs. Shane Helms is out of his fucking mind. He doesn't know what to do with himself. He must be bored. God knows what this guy must be on right now. Now he's signed with Lucha Libre USA. God bless the guy. I hope he goes there and wins championships and makes all the money in the world. This guy is off his fucking rocker. And I don't take a goddamn thing that he says seriously. I really don't care about Shane Helms. I didn't care about him when he was in WWE. I didn't care about him when he was in WCW. And I don't give a shit about him now. So that's my take on Shane Helms. Now, Matt Hardy. Oh, and by the way, before I move on here, there were two other tweets. One of them I just want to mention here, just to show how petty this guy can be. You know, because he's going on and on about how, well, you know, I'm entitled to my own opinion and I can say what I want to about Shawn Michaels. And he's right. He has the freedom to say whatever he wants to. It's his own personal opinion. It's the way he goes about it that I take issue with. But then again, there's this tweet. Somebody sent him a comment about asking him, "Shane, is it true that Mickie James," and I know we have a lot of Mickie James fans who listen to this show, so you'll like this. Anyway, this fan tweeted him and said, Is it true that Mickie James has more ass than a donkey farm? To which Shane Helms responded, twice as much. That's nice. You stay classy. So then we have Matt Hardy, the other dope in the Carolina Cocaine crew here. And Matt Hardy made his TNA debut, his long-anticipated TNA debut at their Genesis pay-per-view last weekend as a surprise opponent for Rob Van Dam. So congratulations to TNA. They brought in a guy that perhaps could have meant something, and they brought him in as a surprise without any build-up at all. Their rating for Impact was up this week to a level that they have not seen since Bound for Glory time in October, which tells you that there was some level of interest in seeing Matt Hardy, so maybe they could have popped a couple of more buys for their pay-per-view, but this is TNA. That's not important to them. Matt Hardy had a tweet of his own on Wednesday that made me shake my head. He says, I want to thank the Scum Sheets for keeping me in the news constantly until I started with TNA. I manipulated them perfectly, suckas. That was his tweet. Now, what he's referring to here, that when he says Scum Sheets, are the big pro wrestling websites and newsletters, like the Wrestling Observer and PW Insider and The Torch and ProWrestling.net and sites like that. Well, here's the deal with this. It wasn't that any of those websites promoted Matt Hardy. It was the fact that Matt Hardy went out there in the time that he had off between WWE and TNA with the intention of making himself look as bad as he possibly could. And maybe that wasn't his intention, but that's how it turned out. I mean, you had actual wrestlers and promoters that worked in the business who would tell these websites, these very same websites that would cover Matt Hardy, that they didn't want to work with the guy. They thought he was fucked up in the head. So who is this guy fooling? Everybody in the world didn't want to touch this guy with a 10-foot pole. You knew Dixie Carter would because they fucking hired Kurt Angle when the guy was on everyone's death pool list. They hired Jeff Hardy, who was under indictment on drug charges. These people don't give a shit. They're the only ones in the world that would have touched Matt Hardy with a 10-foot pole. And then he would have taken that pole and shoved it right up their ass, which I think is what he's going to end up doing anyway. This guy's going to end up doing something to embarrass this company. So yeah, he manipulated them perfectly. If that's what makes him feel good, then fine. Which leads me to Val Venis, okay? Because people wanted me to talk about this. I didn't even want to address this, okay? The story is this. Val Venis is driving in a car. I don't know where he's going, but he's driving in a car. Maybe his next porn shoot. I don't know. And he's got his camera, his cell phone, whatever. He's recording a video as he's driving, which is a no-no right off the bat, okay? Pay fucking attention to the road, you fucking moron, okay? Don't record videos while you're driving. But anyway, he's recording a video while he's driving. It's only like 3 minutes long. And, you know, just the way that he said it, the voice he used, the way he was recording it, made me think work. Right off the bat. So he's going on and on, seemingly out of the clear blue sky. I don't know what would have instigated such a rant. I don't think the Hardys have ever said a bad word about Val Venis or Sean Morley, as it were. But here he is recording this video where he skewers the Hardy Boys. And he skewers Shane Helms and Shannon Moore, and he trashes Omega Wrestling, and he says that, you know, that they're nothing more than trampoline wrestlers who don't know a single thing about the professional wrestling business. And, you know, falling off a ladder is not talent, it's stupidity, and all these different things that, you know, a lot of people you knew were going to agree with, and they were going to say, right on, okay? He said all the right things. And then Matt Hardy posted a video with quote-unquote proof in the form of an email that some wrestling promoter sent him who had a text message conversation with Sean Morley, and in that conversation, Sean Morley seemingly admitted that the whole thing was a work. He was trying to just get an angle going, and he said, you know, if you talk to Matt, just tell him to just bury me on the internet, and who knows, maybe one day we can have a match on the indies over this. Now, mind you, didn't say a word to Matt Hardy about this, so if you're ever going to start an angle with somebody, probably a good idea to let that other person know before you go ahead and do that. Some people might think that Matt Hardy is lying. Look, I don't give a shit. I watched that video the first time before I even saw Matt Hardy's video exposing Sean Morley, and I knew that it was a work. I knew that it was all bullshit. And for the people saying, well, I thought Val worked for WWE. What's he doing? Val had a tryout with WWE as an agent. And my guess is that he wasn't officially hired, at least not yet. Maybe he won't be after this. So as far as I know, he does not work for WWE. As far as I know. Certainly not as an in-ring talent. But it doesn't matter, because this guy made an ass out of himself. He is no better now than Matt Hardy or Shane Helms. I put Val Venus in the same camp as them, which is disappointing to me, because Val has always been known to be a very smart guy. He's very politically inclined, I guess you would say. I think he might be a libertarian. I know Kane is a libertarian, but in any event, he's very knowledgeable on politics, and he's a very articulate person and a very smart guy, or at least I thought he was. When you go and do stupid shit like this, it just makes me shake my head. Is there anything more pathetic than an old fucker going on the internet and posting a video faking these stupid comments just to try to get a reaction and try to get an angle going? Who are you trying to get an angle going for? You don't even work for WWE. You don't work for TNA. You did briefly, and then you got dismissed. Because remember, when the Bischoff-Hogan regime took over, remember, Sean Morley was in TNA for a brief period of time, and even got put over one of their talents. It might have been Jay Lethal. I don't remember. But what's this guy doing these days? He's no better than Shane Helms. Now he's in his car recording videos. What is wrong with these people? That's all I'm going to say about this. I'm moving on here because I've got more important things to talk about, like SmackDown. I did not check all of SmackDown out yet. Obviously, the big story was Wade Barrett had his match with the Big Show. Justin Gabriel and Heath Slater appeared on SmackDown, seemingly to reunite with Wade Barrett after having spurned CM Punk on the Raw brand. And Ezekiel Jackson made his long-anticipated comeback to SmackDown, not as a babyface, as he was when he left Raw, but as a heel. So there's seemingly going to be a second Nexus faction. I would hope they give them a different name on the SmackDown brand. Now, this is interesting in that The Undertaker has been in the news of late as well. Undertaker was at the most recent set of SmackDown tapings. He was backstage, I guess, to spend some time with his wife, Michelle McCool. And apparently he was also there to watch the angle that unfolded involving Heath Slater and Justin Gabriel and Wade Barrett and Ezekiel Jackson. It's important in that Wade Barrett and Ezekiel Jackson are both potential candidates to face The Undertaker in a match at WrestleMania. Now, if I had to choose one over the other, I'd go with Barrett, but quite frankly, neither one of those matches does anything for me. Assuming Undertaker is recovered from shoulder surgery quick enough to have a singles match at WrestleMania, it looks like it will be Barrett, Jackson, or potentially Kane. Kane is still in the running. Obviously, there's some unresolved issues between him and Undertaker going back to their feud from last year, which is the last time we saw Undertaker. If I had to take a guess who it's going to be Wade Barrett, but that's just a guess on my part. I look at this, if he's able to compete, I look at this as a throwaway match for The Undertaker this year. Hopefully he can participate. He'll get his 19th WrestleMania victory, and then they can build to 20-0 next year. Because none of these matches, I mean, look, Undertaker is never going to ever at WrestleMania have another match that can come close to the matches he had with Shawn Michaels, especially that first match at WrestleMania 25. It's just not going to happen. Undertaker is getting older, he's more broken down even than he was before, and there's absolutely nobody the caliber of Shawn Michaels left on that roster to face him. So, it is what it is. At this point, they're trying to get him to 20-0, which I think is when they're going to kind of end the streak, but I think he'll go to 20-0 and call it quits. That's how I feel. But it was interesting that he was there watching the angle unfold. That tells me that he thinks he'll be back before Mania, and maybe sometime around the Elimination Chamber pay-per-view or so, if he's able to, maybe they can bring him back to TV, even if he doesn't wrestle, and they can get something going with either him and Barrett or him and Jackson. I know back at WrestleMania 19, they actually had a handicap match where it was Undertaker against A-Train, and, who else was it? I think it was it A-Train and Heidenreich? I don't remember who it was, but they could go that route and have Undertaker in some sort of tag match or handicap match, but like I said, none of those scenarios light my world on fire. Another kind of big story that, again, maybe didn't get as much attention as it should have this past week was WWE apparently is shying away from hiring wrestlers over the age of 30. Number of older independent wrestlers were informed by WWE officials that they're now seeking to hire talent under the age of 30, especially those that would enter the Florida Championship Wrestling System. It's not an official proclamation of any kind, but apparently close to half a dozen guys were told this in recent weeks when looking into potential work with the company. So if this is true, I just find it to be really sad. At a time when they're bringing in more and more young guys who are very green and don't necessarily know what they're doing, or if they do, they're not necessarily ready to be on TV, and you have fewer and fewer veterans around to not only wrestle them, but just put them over, you know, maybe help teach them a thing or two in working with them on the road. Shawn Michaels is retired, and Jericho is gone for now, and even Triple H is kind of winding down, and Mysterio isn't even doing house shows anymore at this point until at least next month. He's still so beat up. You know, why you would want to kind of have this blanket declaration that we're just not looking for anybody over the age of 30? I mean, it just doesn't make any sense to me, and it just makes me think, I mean, again, it's not an official edict in writing or anything, so good luck proving it, but this is age discrimination is what this is. You know, this gets out and becomes a bigger story. This could be a real headache for WWE. I mean, that's not the type of business practice that you want to be enforcing, I don't think. So, again, it's just a foolish thing to me. It's kind of like that edict that Vince McMahon passed down years ago when he said they were only looking for guys that were like 6'2" and taller. I mean, really? Some of the best performers you've ever had in the history of your company are 6 foot tall or under. You know, they're calling Shawn Michaels now. The new thing with Shawn, since he signed this long-term contract with the company and they're honoring him at the Hall of Fame, he's the best of all time. They're calling Shawn Michaels the best in-ring performer of all time. And if he's not the best, he's certainly among the best. But Shawn Michaels is not 6'2". So if Shawn Michaels were coming up in WWE in the last 5 years, what that means is there would have been a fairly good chance that he would not have been given a second look, or he would not have been given a shot. Or somebody in upper management would have looked at him and whispered to Vince, hey, this guy's not big enough. He, you know, he just doesn't have it. I think I've talked about this, I think, in the past as well. If Mick Foley were coming up in the business right now, do you think, I mean, honestly, do you think a guy like Mick Foley, looking the way that he does, even when he was slimmer back in the day, and I don't think Mick Foley was ever all that slim, but do you think they would give him a second look? They wouldn't even let him in the door. They'd give him a mop and say, here, go clean the bathroom. And yet, you know, Dusty Rhodes never had a physique that was all that pleasant to look at, but he was one hell of a charismatic performer in the ring, and, you know, multiple-time world champion, and a booker, and everything else. Imagine how many guys would never have gotten a second look. The wrestling business would look very different today for the worse if that had happened. So I don't agree with this at all. I think it's a poor decision on their part. And I think it's something they need to reconsider, because you've got all these older guys that are breaking down and they're retiring, and, you know, it's great that you've got all these younger guys now, but if you're just going to have young guys working with young guys who aren't necessarily all ready to be on TV, some of them are, many of them aren't, that's a problem. I mean, look at Jackson Andrews, Tyson Kidd's would-be bodyguard, who was on TV for all of 2 weeks before being, you know, manhandled by Mark Henry and then never heard from again. From what I understand, the reason that that happened was they didn't fire the guy, but they realized that he wasn't ready, and they sent him back to Florida Championship Wrestling. Why would you put the guy on TV if you knew he wasn't ready? You didn't know this in advance? I mean, he didn't do much on TV. What did he do? He stood there with his arms crossed. He attacked somebody once. He didn't cripple the guy. He didn't offend me in any way. He didn't do much. How is it that they didn't realize beforehand that this guy wasn't ready, and then him being on TV for 2 weeks and doing nothing made somebody go, huh, this guy's not ready? Triple H has a Q&A, speaking of veterans, in the February 2011 issue of WWE Magazine. And Triple H, who, you know, and I've been saying this for a long time now, but he is on his way back very soon. Not only is his movie coming out, The Chaperone, on in theaters and on DVD next month, but he's already listed on the Madison Square Garden house show lineup for March 19th in a street fight with Sheamus. So that right there tells you what Triple H is going to be doing when he comes back. Anyway, he had a Q&A in the latest magazine, and there was one quote in there I wanted to read that I thought was kind of interesting to note. This is what Triple H says. He goes, in the past, my goal was just becoming the WWE champion or the world heavyweight champion. but there's a certain time when you get beyond that. Shawn Michaels moved beyond that. I don't have to be contending for a championship. Undertaker doesn't have to be in contention. Well, tell that to the writers on SmackDown. We've moved beyond needing a title to prove that we're the best. That's where I am now. John Cena will eventually be there. So, you read that comment, and it makes you think that Triple H has had an epiphany, that he has found religion in some way, in that he has finally come to the realization that he does not have to win a world championship every month, or beat Ric Flair's record of 16 titles to necessarily consider himself a success in the business. I think Triple H has already carved out a rather comfortable niche for himself in WWE, and you know, future Hall of Famer, 13-time world champion. He's won King of the Ring and Royal Rumble, and he's led two different factions in the whole nine yards. It would be nice. I said before that Triple H has been gone long enough where he's almost fresh to me now, and I'm looking forward to his return. Now, maybe he'll come back, and within a few weeks I'll regret saying those words. But if Triple H comes back and resumes his feud with Sheamus and moves on to some fresh feuds and helps put talent over, which doesn't mean Triple H should be jobbing to all the younger guys, but at the same time, he shouldn't be beating all of them and putting them in a box and sending them back to Ohio Valley Wrestling like he did with the Spirit Squad. So if those words are the truth and it's not just lip service that he's paying all of us, then thumbs up to Triple H. It's about time that he realized that. Triple H is one of those guys who can go to WrestleMania and does not have to be in the championship match. You can get more mileage out of WrestleMania by putting Triple H, one of your biggest stars, in a separate match and having the title match featured separately, so you almost have like a double main event type of thing. But you don't have to put Triple H in all the title matches. Now, I've also said recently that Triple H seems to be gaining more and more influence behind the scenes. Vince McMahon is not going anywhere anytime soon, at least we hope not. But he's been put in charge of certain events. There was a European tour not too long ago that Vince did not go on, and Triple H was in charge. And, you know, the announcers probably loved it because he wasn't producing the announcers the way that Vince McMahon does and yelling at them. He kind of let them do their own thing, and a lot of the wrestlers seem to like the idea of Triple H being more in charge because he is, quote-unquote, one of the boys, and again, unless he has a personal political beef with you, maybe he's not all that bad of a guy. Now, of course, if he doesn't like you for some reason, then you're pretty much fucked. But taking all that into account, there was an interesting stat here from the latest Wrestling Observer. I want to read this to you. The $41 million in WWE stock sold by Vince McMahon at the end of 2010 was nearly the amount of money that Linda McMahon spent in her Senate race, which, of course, was just shy of $50 million. Anyway, the point to all this is Vince McMahon currently owns 59% of World Wrestling Entertainment, which is down from the 70% that Vince owned for most of the past decade. So still, Vince McMahon is a majority owner of World Wrestling Entertainment, but he actually, his ownership stake in the company has steadily decreased to the tune of 11%. That's I didn't realize that. That is a sobering thought that, you know, WWE, which is synonymous with Vince McMahon, it's his own company, and he owns less than 60% of it. So I figured I'd throw that in there. Quick bit of TNA news here. Scott Steiner made his comeback at the recent set of TNA tapings. Came out at the end of the show and was there to save Kurt Angle, I guess. Looks like they're setting up some sort of, some form, anyway, of a main event mafia return. I don't know what the status is of Sting and Kevin Nash. If you believe Nash, he's not coming back. He is gone for real from TNA, if he is to be believed. And Sting, I know they're still trying to sign him to a new contract, so he's either going to sign with TNA and be part of this angle, or he won't, and perhaps he'll accept WWE's offer if they make him one to be part of the Hall of Fame. But it looks like they're setting up for Main Event Mafia versus Immortal sometime next month. And TNA announced that they will be doing an Impact. I don't know if they actually announced it yet or not, but they will be doing an episode of Impact on February 24th. Outside of Orlando, they're leaving the Impact Zone. Hallelujah. For one night, at least. They're going to be in Fayetteville, North Carolina, which I believe, I had read that it was the Hardy Boys' hometown. I was always under the impression that that was Cameron, North Carolina, but either way, they're in North Carolina, the home state of the Hardys, Flair country, if you will. It will not be a live show on Spike TV. But they will be doing a TV taping that night for March 3rd and March 10th. So for the people who are wondering if that meant Impact was going live for one night, they are not. At least not at this point. And the last little nugget here I wanted to share that I thought was kind of interesting to look back on. This is from a November 1993 edition of the Wrestling Observer newsletter, which I was reading this past week. And I just thought this was just fascinating. Anyway, here's the paragraph. Quote, both the New York Daily News and the Miami Herald, which is syndicated nationally on the Knight Ridder News Service, ran stories this past week about University of Miami defensive tackle Dwayne Johnson, talking about him being the son of longtime pro wrestler Rocky Johnson. The New York story did not mention that he was the grandson of the late chief Peter Maivia, although it was emphasized in the Miami story. Johnson, who is 6'5", 275 pounds, is a redshirt junior who splits time in a rotating foursome at defensive tackle and will likely someday end up in pro wrestling. Well, I'll say so. And thank God for that. I think we're all better off that The Rock ended up in pro wrestling and his football career did not pan out perhaps the way that he had hoped. And pretty sure if you talk to Dwayne Johnson these days and ask him if he would go back and change anything, that he probably would not change a thing considering where he's at right now in life. So anyway, I thought that was kind of interesting. That was back from November of 93. All right, so we're going to break into the mailbag right now. Got a lot of letters, as always, to get to, including one that I want to start off here with. This letter is from one of our longtime listeners, Mario. And I just want to apologize to him because he sent this letter back on Christmas Eve. And as will sometimes happen with Gmail, at least, it got sucked up into the spam folder. And I did not see this letter until I was cleaning out my spam folder and I saw it in there. So I apologize for not getting to this sooner. He says, Mr. Solid Monster, if you had the chance to book a WWE event and were told to put 5 matches on it, and each match must be an old-school WWE wrestler or legend against a new-school guy, who would you pick to go against who? And I gave this question some thought. I thought it was certainly an interesting question and very subjective. But if I had to put together a card of 5 matches of past WWE guys against current ones that I think would make for fine matches on a pay-per-view, for example, 5 matches I would put together are, in no particular order, The Rock and John Cena. I think that would make for quite a match and quite a contrast, really, between, you know, Attitude versus PG and all that stuff. But Rock and Cena would be a fantastic choice. I think Steve Austin and CM Punk, which I've been advocating for a long time. I think I might have actually first mentioned Austin versus Punk back on, like, episode 26. I think episode 26 might have been the very first special edition of the Sound Off, and I did 5 fantasy feuds, and I think I talked about Austin versus Punk on that show. I still think it would make a great match. You know, especially the straight-edge CM Punk against the beer-drinking, finger-flipping Steve Austin. I think it would be, a fine battle between those two gentlemen. Shawn Michaels and John Morrison, certainly the Shawn Michaels in his prime against the John Morrison of today, would make for a fantastic athletic contest. Here's one that maybe you haven't thought of: Randy Orton, one-on-one with Jake the Snake Roberts. We saw Orton and Jake interact once on Raw back on an edition of Chris Jericho's highlight reel. This was before WrestleMania 21 when they brought in Jake to warn Randy Orton about challenging The Undertaker to a match at WrestleMania, which, of course, Jake had fallen victim back at WrestleMania 8 to the Deadman, and the segment ended with Orton giving Jake an RKO. It's obvious to me that Orton has patterned at least part of his character after Jake the Snake in terms of, I guess, psychologically and just, you know, in terms of how his matches are laid out and the very slow, you know, methodical motions that he uses. And his promos are shit compared to Jake's, but he tries to make everything mean something. There's no wasted motion with Orton. And I think I have to think he took some of that, at least, from Jake. And Jake in his prime, before his, you know, he suffered a neck injury and just physically in the ring wasn't what he once was. But in his prime, coupled with his promo ability and his amazing psychology, Roberts and Orton, I think, could have a fantastic, you know, battle of wits and a great match, I think. And last but not least, a match that I certainly would like to see with both guys in their prime. Daniel Bryan one-on-one with Bret the Hitman Hart. I think if you're a wrestling fan, a real wrestling fan, there can be very few matches, aside from that one, that can be a wrestling fan's wet dream, for lack of a better term, and that would be one of them, I think. Bret and Daniel Bryan would have, I have no doubt, a phenomenal match. So those are the five matches that I came up with. There's a million more that you can come up with, you know, Austin versus Hogan, or Cena versus Hogan, or, you know, Rock and Shawn Michaels, but I think if you're looking at stars from the roster today against some of the great legends of the past who can actually go inside that ring, those are just five of the best matches that you could possibly come up with. Matthew in East Belfast, Northern Ireland, writes in, "Dear Solid Monster, been listening to the Sound Off since episode 130. Doing a great job. Keep up the good work. Having seen WWE's plans for WrestleMania 27 regarding the WWE Championship, that being Miz versus John Cena, I think that given the Miz is currently feuding with Randy Orton and Cena is currently feuding with CM Punk, a better match would be Miz versus Cena versus Orton versus Punk in a fatal four-way for the WWE Championship. First pinfall or submission wins it, not that elimination crap. Would you like to see that as a WrestleMania match? And if you were Vince McMahon, who would you have winning that match? If you don't like that idea, what do you think WWE should do instead?" Well, as I told Matthew in my email back to him, I'm tired of all the gimmick matches. You know, the main event of WrestleMania should be a straight-up singles match. My guess is we get Miz versus Cena for the title. And if so, I'm actually fine with that. It's a match that hasn't been beaten to death a million times and would at least seem fresh, for as fresh as you can get with Cena headlining another pay-per-view. You can also transition into an Orton versus Punk feud heading into Mania, so that's another potential match for you, unless they want to carry the Punk-Cena stuff into Mania, which, again, I would not have a problem with that. You and I happen to disagree on the rules for multiple man matches. I much rather prefer the elimination rules, which is the way it was done everywhere, pretty much, except WWE. I mean, WWE, with few exceptions, would always have triple threat matches in fatal four-ways where the first fall wins it, and I hated it. I just hated it. And, you know, the only example I could think of, like, big-time example, was actually WrestleMania 2000. They actually had two different examples of this. They had a triple threat match for the European and Intercontinental titles with Chris Jericho, Chris Benoit, and Kurt Angle. Now, in that match, it was not one fall to a finish. Each fall was for a different championship. And the main event was actually a fatal four-way elimination match. It was Big Show, Mick Foley, Triple H, and The Rock. You know, Big Show went out first, then Foley, and then ultimately Triple H won. I still would have had a straight match between Rock and Triple H at Mania that year, but aside from those examples, WWE always did it where it was one fall to a finish, and I didn't like it. You know, eliminations keep the action going, and it keeps you guessing as to who might be going out next. So, again, you and I can disagree on that, but it's kind of a moot point anyway, because I would not want a multiple-man match as the main event of WrestleMania. Liam in the UK writes in, "Dear Solid Monster, I've noticed that the UK and Irish talent are being pushed pretty hard in WWE, so I had an idea for a storyline, considering that where I live, here in England, has mercilessly beaten the shit out of a lot of countries on this planet. I was wondering if it would be a good idea to take a superstar from each country within the UK and make them all fight to see which country would be declared the best. We have Wade Barrett from England, Drew McIntyre from Scotland, Sheamus from Ireland, Finlay from Northern Ireland, and the rising of a Welsh guy in developmental whose name escapes me. Anyway, I just wanted to ask your opinion on whether or not this would be a good storyline." As I told Liam, it's a storyline that only folks in the UK would really care about, maybe. So I would nix this idea. It's a creative one. I mean, I'll give you that. But maybe tweak it a bit and host some sort of international invitational tournament type deal where you take a star each representing a country completely different from the other, and have them battle it out for bragging rights. You know, again, I don't know how much interest there might be in something like that, but it would have to be expanded beyond just the UK region in order for it to have any shot at succeeding. This question is from David. Zach Gowen said in a Shoot interview that he was disliked in the locker room so much that when a kayfabe angle came up where he was knocked out, the locker room watching in the back cheered. He mentioned that due to his attitude and heat in the locker room, he was fired. Personally, I find it hard to believe that Zach had a dark side due to his handicap, Were the superstars just impatient with his disability? What's your take on why Zach Gowen was fired? Gowen was known for having a chip on his shoulder, and that rubbed people the wrong way. So, I mean, it's true some guys did balk at potentially doing jobs to essentially a one-legged man, but his release had everything to do with his poor attitude. I just don't think he was ready for that level of a push that he got in WWE, back in 03. Steve in Pennsylvania has an interesting idea for WrestleMania. If Vince McMahon is successful in courting Sting for the Hall of Fame induction and perhaps a match at Mania, why not have him face Jerry the King Lawler? Jerry has been begging for a match at the grandest stage of them all for quite some time now, and I think it could be billed as a first time ever between two legends. Do you think that would be a good match? If so, how would you lead into it? I don't know how I would lead into it, per se. I probably would just build it up as a battle between two legends who, you know what? Two legends who, neither of which have ever in their careers, for all their championships and all their success, have had a match at WrestleMania. There you go. Just came up with it on the spot. Sting has never had a WrestleMania match. Jerry Lawler, for all his years in WWE, has never had a match at WrestleMania. You don't need to manufacture some bullshit feud in order to pull off a match like this. Do I like the idea of Sting and King? Not as much as I like Sting and The Undertaker, just because I think if they could get Sting and convince him that he's doing the job to Undertaker, because he ain't breaking the streak, I like that match better than Undertaker Wade Barrett or Undertaker Ezekiel Jackson, and for shit sure, you know, better than Undertaker and Kane. But you know what? It's an interesting concept, King and Sting, and I wouldn't mind it because, like I said, Jerry Lawler, you know, he deserves a match at WrestleMania, at least one time in his career. He's been featured so prominently on Raw over the last couple of months, and he's delivered virtually every single time. I think he's only had one off week, you know, where he looked a little off in that last singles match he had with Miz. But, you know, King was in the ring again on Raw this past Monday night, and he got the win. He got the pinfall. All of this makes me think they're going somewhere. That, you know, maybe they are building to a Mania match for him finally. I don't think at all that it's with Sting, but this is one of those outside-the-box ideas that I kind of like in a way. It's not the first match I would put up there, but if I did, the easiest way to build it up is just, again, two legends of the business who have just about done it all. Neither man has ever had a match at WrestleMania. So this match means more to each man than anybody could imagine, and both men are going into this looking for a victory. There you go. There's your story. Very simple. See, this comes from James. Do you think, in a way, that Nexus is like another revamped WWE version of the NWO? Yes, only less successful. This question comes from Taylor in Albany, Georgia. What's up, Solo Monster? I had the honor of being in the arena in 1994 when WCW had the only two Thunder Cage matches in the history of the company. What are your thoughts on the matches, and would either WWE or TNA, or as he says, Total Nonstop Abomination, consider bringing it, or a form of it, back for one night? As I said to Taylor in the email I sent back to him very succinctly, I said, are you sure you had the honor or the horror of being in attendance for those matches? It's unlikely WWE is going to bring it back. They won't even use War Games because it was a WCW idea, so therefore that must make it bad. Chaz from California writes in, after watching Monday Night Raw and seeing Shawn Michaels give some sweet chin music to Alberto Del Rio, do you think HBK is going to make an in-ring return? Shawn Michaels has wrestled his last match for the foreseeable future. He's back for the Hall of Fame, probably a couple of TV appearances maybe beforehand. That's it. There will be no Michaels-Del Rio match at WrestleMania, even though you would think that segment would almost set one up. That is not the case. This person writes into the Sound Off, will Shawn Michaels be the first Grand Slam champion to be in the WWE Hall of Fame? I have a feeling you know what a Grand Slam champion is. Could you explain to your listeners what a Grand Slam champion is for those who may not know, and what a wrestler has to do to be called it? Love the show. Listen to you on my PS3. Once upon a time, when there was only a world title, intercontinental tag, and European title in WWF, to be a Grand Slam champion meant that you would hold all of those titles in your career. And Shawn Michaels was technically the first Grand Slam champion in WWE history. That's how they built him. He was a world champion, he was an intercontinental champion, tag champion, and then he won the European title for a couple of months in 1997. That being said, I don't think Sean would technically be the first Grand Slam champion in the Hall of Fame. I would imagine that if you're going by that criteria, and again, there's been so many other, you know, the proliferation of titles in wrestling over the years since that European belt was retired is just ridiculous. So the definition in 2011 of a Grand Slam champion is far different than what it would have been in 1997. But Eddie Guerrero held the European title. He was also an Intercontinental champion. He won the tag team belts with Chavo. And, of course, he beat Brock Lesnar to be the WWE champion. And Eddie went into the Hall of Fame in 2006. So I guess Eddie technically would be the first, and Shawn Michaels would probably be number two. Steve writes into the Sound Off. A lot of people seem to bitch, but I thought the Hogan segment last week was well-deserved on the Sound Off. Thanks for telling it like it is. I had actually stopped the podcast after your Hogan Warrior kickout comment and go watch the match. Brought back some good memories. Anyway, at the end, when Warrior is holding up both the Intercontinental and World titles, I was wondering two things. Number one, how many people have held both at the same time? And who was the last one to do so? Well, to the best of my knowledge, I think there have only been, I want to say, two guys who have done that. Warrior would be one, and I think Diesel would be the other one. Hold on a second. Let me give this some thought here. No, I take that back. What am I saying, Diesel? Diesel didn't hold both, but he didn't hold them at the same time. You know, the last one I could remember, and probably the last one to do it, technically speaking, would have been Triple H back in 2002 when he beat Kane to unify the world and Intercontinental titles. That was when they did away with the Intercontinental belt altogether, and then they finally came to their senses and reinstated the belt in May of the following year. So again, he wasn't technically a dual champion, but he did win them both at the same time and then unify them. Besides Triple H and Warrior, I don't know that anybody else held them simultaneously in WWE. And of course, when Warrior did that, he was immediately stripped by President Jack Tunney of the Intercontinental belt because of some weird declaration. He said you couldn't defend both belts at the same time or some bullshit like that. It was kind of like the declaration before their match at WrestleMania 6 when Tunney said that this would be the one and only time Hogan and Warrior would ever face each other. There would be no rematch because it was a match that, you know, the WWF can only handle once. It was utter nonsense. Meanwhile, what were they planning to do? They were originally planning for a Hogan Warrior rematch at WrestleMania the following year before they changed their minds. So much for stipulations. David writes in, do you ever feel as though you have to lower your standards to enjoy some of what WWE or TNA gives us these days? Not saying wrestling today is by any means terrible, but sometimes I feel like I'm grasping at straws when it comes to finding reasons to watch the entire show. Love the new intros lately, and for the record, I never have to lower my standards to enjoy the Sound Off. Well, that's nice of you to say. I don't think it's so much lowering your standards as much as it's a matter of managing one's expectations. You know, there was a time when Raw was must-see TV, and you would expect a big angle and crazy crowd reactions every single week. You know, what vehicle was Steve Austin going to come riding in on this week, and all these different things. And when that stopped happening, the shows felt a little less important and a little more boring and lackluster. And, you know, again, you're comparing one era to another, which is somewhat unfair. I don't lower my standards to watch Raw. You know, if there's parts of Raw that are boring or suck, I call them out on it. And sometimes I'll even skip over it. I'll flip channels. It's just things are different now than they were then. Again, there's certain maneuvers that have been banned that you don't see. I mean, it's been years since we've seen a traditional pile driver used on WWE TV, again, aside from the Tombstone. As a matter of fact, the ban on pile drivers probably goes back to 2002 or 2003. Now, back in the day, pile drivers were commonplace. And it's one of those things where if somebody busted out a pile driver now, it would mean so much more. You know what I mean? I mean, I would hope that it would be showcased as part of a major injury angle, and people would be shocked and dismayed to see this, because we've been conditioned now after all these years to not expect certain things. So when they do happen, it's more shocking and it leaves more of an impression on us. So, you know, when you say lowering your standards when you watch wrestling now, I guess compared to yesteryear, like I said, you're managing expectations because you're not going to get what you used to get. And wrestling now, as god-awful as it can sometimes be, And that's more a matter of certain segments and certain matches. You know, wrestling is not terrible. If wrestling was that terrible, I wouldn't be watching it anymore. The reason I continue to watch, and you continue to watch, and a lot of people continue to watch, is either A, there are people out there who don't think wrestling is any worse than it was 10 years ago. If anything, they think it's better, and they love it. They love all of it. They love WWE, they love TNA, they love ROH. God bless those people. I wish I could be as optimistic as those people are. And then there's other people, like I think, you know, I would fall into this camp, where I don't think wrestling is nearly as fun, per se, as it used to be. There's certain elements and whatnot that are really, really good, and then there's things that they do on these shows that are really, really awful and make you scratch your head. But there's always hope, which is what I was getting at as far as why everybody watches. Some people want to return to the Attitude Era. Some people just want, you know, more wrestling and less talk. Some people like the sports entertainment, but they want less comedy, or they want less bullshit, or they want more edginess. Everybody wants something different. But everybody watches and continues to watch because they have hope that at some point things are going to turn around and things are going to change. And yeah, that's the best way I could describe it. It's a good question, though. I mean, I see the point you're trying to make, but like I said, managing expectations, not lowering your standards, a big difference there. This message comes from Keith. I don't know if you remember. I mentioned a letter on the Sound Off last week from Keith that he had sent me right around Christmas time, where he was actually writing us from the hospital. His wife was about to give birth. Apparently, she still hasn't. The doctor said that their new baby would be arriving sometime within the next 2 weeks. And he says that it's safe to say they will not be naming him Dolph Ziggler, because he heard my rant last week on Dolph's name. His name will be Peyton, or I'm sorry, not Peyton, Preston, I'm sorry. Big difference. His name will be Preston, and yes, he will be a future WWE star. The podcast was awesome. I do agree with your thoughts on Hulk Hogan. His current situation is being overshadowed. Who do you think will be the newest Hall of Fame inductee? I heard there's going to be up to 3 huge names. I personally think Sting or Goldberg will be one of them, if not both. With 3 huge names like that, it's safe to say this year's Hall of Fame will be epic. Well, let's not get ahead of ourselves just yet. I heard the same thing you did, that there were up to 2 other names that they had negotiated with and reached deals with for the Hall of Fame. Could it be Sting or Goldberg? Sure. They've had discussions before. It wouldn't shock me. Just because Shawn Michaels is going to be the main event attraction this year does not mean, by any means, that Goldberg or Sting can't still go in this year. Believe me, if WWE can reach a deal with either one of those guys, they're going in. They're not going to wait. But the only thing I've heard, and I might have heard this from Dave Meltzer, but the only name that I've heard, and I don't think this would qualify as one of the 2 big names I just talked about, is the Big Boss Man is apparently being considered, again, with names like Arn Anderson and Ron Simmons and Lex Luger. Again, I haven't heard Vader's name mentioned. I don't know why, especially if we're going to put some WCW guys in there. You know, Vader deserves to go into the Hall of Fame, and I've made this argument before, so I'm not going to get into it again, but I've been hearing Big Boss Man, and you know, my thoughts on that are this. I personally would not think to put Boss Man in the Hall of Fame, at least not right now. Also a little surprising to me in that they would go ahead and put somebody in there who is no longer with us, although they'll sometimes put 1 or 2 people like that in the Hall of Fame. But I could think of a bunch of other names other than Ray Traylor to go into the Hall of Fame. At the same time, when you have people in the Hall of Fame like James Dudley, okay, who is Vince McMahon's limo driver, and people, all due respect, like Nikolai Volkoff and Coco Beware in the Hall of Fame, it becomes a little more difficult to not consider people like the Big Boss Man, who he himself never held a championship title in WWE. Well, he held the hardcore title, I guess, if you want to count that as a real title. But he was never a world champion or an intercontinental. You know what? I'm completely wrong about this. Boss Man was a tag team champion. What the hell am I thinking about? He was a tag champion with Ken Shamrock. Well, there you go. If titles are important to you, then I guess he held titles. But the point is, Boss Man would not be on my short list of people going into the Hall of Fame. And there's been some discussion, at least serious discussion, about perhaps putting him in this year. I know he was very well liked by the people in WWE, and he did a lot of charitable work that I wasn't even aware that he did until he died and all these stories came out about what a charitable guy he was. You know, he had a career for himself in WCW as well. not terribly successful, but nonetheless, he competed there too. So we'll see. I mean, again, Bossman going into the Hall would not be my first pick, but when you have people like James Dudley and Nikolai Volkoff and Coco Beware in the Hall of Fame, you know what? Sure. Why not? Why not put the Bossman in there? Ash from Australia writes in, "Dear Solo Monster, I know you don't cover much UFC in the podcast, but what are your thoughts on Brock Lesnar being named one of the coaches in the next season of The Ultimate Fighter? And was this part of Dana White's plan to try and keep Brock Lesnar from returning to WWE for WrestleMania this year?" It was not part of any plan at all. As a matter of fact, there was some discussion that the only way they would get Brock to be a coach on The Ultimate Fighter and you know, be away from home all those weeks, you know, taping the show in Vegas, would be to concede, well, not concede to his demands per se. Brock wanted to do WrestleMania. That is true. Brock Lesnar wanted to do WrestleMania because it was an easy payday for him. It would probably be $2 or $3 million easy for him to be what? A referee? Who wouldn't want to do that? And if anything, there was talk that the only way Brock would agree to do The Ultimate Fighter would be if Dana allowed him to do WrestleMania. And guess what? Dana got him to be a coach on The Ultimate Fighter, and he still is not letting Brock do WrestleMania. So it's not his way of keeping him from doing it. He wasn't doing it anyway because he's under contract to UFC. He's under contract to Dana White, an exclusive contract. So by the letter of the law, he can't do it no matter what. And he won't be at WrestleMania. And I hope Vince McMahon, who up until a week or two ago still thought that he had a legitimate shot of Brock being there, hopefully now Vince has come to his senses and realized he's got to move on to Plan B here. As far as Brock being a coach, I think it's awesome for UFC. Brock is their biggest draw. He is the biggest star in UFC who actually noticeably draws for them, whether it's ratings or pay-per-view buys. I mean, he is to UFC what Mike Tyson was to the boxing industry in terms of pay-per-view revenue once upon a time, and not quite at that level. But again, being that one big star that you could put on a card and probably pop an easy million buys, Brock is your man. You know, whenever they replay any of Brock's fights from those big UFC pay-per-views on Spike TV, you know, months later they'll replay these specials on Spike TV with you know, like Lesnar fights, and those fights consistently do the highest ratings that any of those types of UFC specials do on the network. So all of a sudden you've got Brock Lesnar, this great big attraction who's going to be a coach. He's going to coach these young punks on The Ultimate Fighter, and you know, again, the opposing coach is going to be Junior Dos Santos, who will be Brock's opponent. When the season is over, he and Brock will have a pay-per-view fight. So, essentially, not only does The Ultimate Fighter serve to promote these younger, newer fighters, and hopefully you'll get a new star out of it, or maybe more than one new star, but at the same time, you're also hyping this fight between Lesnar and Dos Santos. There's going to no doubt be a lot of trash-talking, a lot of drama over the course of the season, and it wouldn't shock me if this was one of the higher-rated seasons that the show has ever had. This is going to be the 13th season of the show. And when it looked like the show was kind of starting to die a death, they had Kimbo Slice as a contestant on the show, and ratings soared. It might have been their highest-rated season ever. And then I think they sagged a little bit. Well, now you're going to see ratings spike right back up. So, you know, Dana White and UFC are no dummies. They know what they're doing. Ash had a PS here in his email. I just want to read it here. He has a shout-out to all of the Queenslanders that have been affected by the Queensland flood crisis down in Australia. Just to wants to let them know that the rest of Australia is working together to raise money to help you through this, and that you are not alone. All the best of wishes go out to the families who have lost someone or who have had someone close missing at the present time. This letter comes from Nathan O'Brien, dear Solo Monster. I don't know if the news about the Queensland floods has reached you in America yet, but I was wondering if you could just give us a shout out on the next Sound Off and encourage anybody to donate to the Flood Disaster Relief Fund. Disaster has been classified as an inland tsunami and has left thousands homeless and many dead. It's Thursday night, and I have not been near a computer since last Sunday. I jumped back on the net to hear the Sound Off and check out what's going on at SE Scoops. Link to the support website, I'm going to read that now, is www.granthamfloodsupport.com. That's www.granthamfloodsupport.com. If I do make it onto the Sound Off, I was just wondering if you can maybe share some knowledge you have about Australian professional wrestling, perhaps some Australian wrestlers who have made it into America. The only Australian professional wrestler I know of is Nathan Jones in WWE in 2003. Do you know anything more? My knowledge of, and by the way, the I did hear about the floods down there, which is just an awful thing, and I would certainly concur and encourage anybody listening to do what they can, whether you're down in Australia or not, to support the folks down there. Again, that website is GranthamFloodSupport.com. But as far as Australian wrestlers are concerned, my knowledge is fairly limited on that subject. I do know that the Fabulous Kangaroos, and I did not know each of their real names. Apparently it's Roy Heffernan and Al Costello. But I had heard of the Fabulous Kangaroos before, and I think they would probably be the only Australian wrestlers to really become big stars overseas in the U.S., and I believe they held the tag team titles in the WWWF. So, certainly more so than Nathan Jones, because let's be honest, if Nathan Jones is the only thing your country is known for, that's pretty sad. And Australia is known for a lot more than Nathan Jones, so give yourself a little bit more credit than that. The Kangaroos would probably be the most popular ones. I did look something up on the web, and I think it might also be on Wikipedia, but I wasn't aware of this. I didn't even know this existed, but apparently the only major promotion to ever operate successfully in Australia, which would have been in the 60s and the 70s, was called WCW Australia, which, of course, is not to be confused with World Championship Wrestling in the United States, although it was known as World Championship Wrestling in Australia as well. They had a television deal. They were, like I said, the biggest promotion in the country at the time. They had a lot of international stars pass through there. Killer Kowalski, you know, Ray Stevens, Carl Gotch, Bruno Sammartino, Gorilla Monsoon. And unfortunately, when they lost their television deal, the promotion was forced to fold in 1978. So, a little bit of Australian trivia there for you. I had no idea there was a World Championship Wrestling separate from the one here in the U.S. that apparently was a big deal down in Australia. So, there you go. Eddie writes into the podcast. This is Eddie from Ireland. Listen to your podcast every week. Keep up the great work. In your latest mailbag last week, you mentioned how Sheamus could not afford another loss. And as it turns out, he hasn't won a pay-per-view match since July. If he's to be taken seriously as a powerhouse, do you think WWE have dropped the ball here? I like how he's had good matches and all, but he doesn't seem to have a problem taking the fall. Out of his match series with John Morrison, he's lost 3 out of 4 times. Yes, he did win King of the Ring, but it's a victory surrounded by a loss. What can be done by WWE to help Sheamus? Well, it's very simple. Book him better. I mean, that's really, at the end of the day, book him better and get rid of that ridiculous, stupid outfit that he wears to the ring because he's turning into a comedy figure. And it's bad enough if he's turning into a comedy figure, but when he's turning into a comedy figure and losing most of his matches, that's a problem. I mean, you know, this is a very simple formula here. You had built up Sheamus as this badass monster who went undefeated for quite a long time before he finally lost. You know, and he held the championship. Now, granted, both title victories were very fluky wins. You know, when he won the title for the first time, it was, you know, by accident, quote-unquote, by just pushing John Cena off the top through a table at the TLC pay-per-view in 09. And when he won the title from Cena, it was in a fatal four-way, and he essentially stole a pinfall in that four-way match. I was at that pay-per-view. That was when Nexus interfered. And he literally won the championship and ran off into the crowd. And people almost didn't even recognize that he had won the title at the time. Nonetheless, he's a two-time world champion. I think he's maybe more so than any of the younger guys that they have been pushing to the main event in the last several months. Sheamus has taken the ball and ran with it to the point where I look at him as a main eventer. I don't look at him as a mid-carder. And the fact that he's being treated as one now is troubling to me because WWE, it's almost like one step forward, two steps back. They need desperately to push new people into the main event and keep them there. And I feel like Sheamus is taking a couple of steps back, and WWE really can't afford for that to happen. So it's very simple. Book him better and get rid of that ridiculous outfit. I mean, I think he's going to be in this feud with Triple H. He's probably going to come out on the losing end of it. And if so, that's to be expected. But after that, they're going to have to do something to rehabilitate his character because, and I didn't even realize that he has not won a pay-per-view match since July, if that is true. That's really quite ridiculous. So they're going to have to do something about that. Daniel in Kentucky. Dear Solemn Monster, I'm a relatively new listener, been listening since episode 125. I remember hearing you talk about and reading on SC Scoops that WWE was interested in unifying the WWE and world titles, perhaps by WrestleMania. I have not heard that possibility bandied about again. My question is if WWE is still exploring this possibility or if the idea has now been scrapped. I have not heard a new word about any of this in the last month or two. There was definitely talk about unifying the titles at WrestleMania. And again, as with many things, they changed their mind and wanted to go in a different direction. I know there's people that'll say, oh, well, you know, this was made up out of thin air. It's really easy to just say that WWE always changes its mind. They do. And you can find countless examples of this. They have given some thought in the past, including recently, to unifying the belts. And they obviously decided against it. It does not mean that it cannot happen in 2011. It just means that at this point, it probably will not be happening this year at WrestleMania. Because right now they have other plans. And again, plans have changed dramatically. I mean, Edge and Dolph Ziggler was not going to be the title match at the Royal Rumble as of 3 months ago. So you know, Miz. You know, they looked at Miz as having a relatively short title reign. And he may still have a short title reign. I expect him to leave the Rumble with the belt, but who knows? They're constantly changing their minds. So I have not heard anything new about unification and would not expect that anytime in the near future. James has been a listener since episode 10. His question is, what is your favorite finishing maneuver of all time? He likes the Diamond Cutter. Well, Diamond Cutter and the RKO are essentially the same move. And I love the way Diamond Dallas Page used to execute that move. It literally could be delivered from any position out of nowhere, and the crowd would pop huge for it. DDP was over so much more than his push would have allowed for, and it should have allowed for in WCW. It was ridiculous. Orton has essentially adopted the same exact move. You know, he puts his little spin on it where he'll bang on the mat. He kind of, people know most of the time when Orton is going to hit this move. I like the way that DDP did it better, just because most of the time it was not telegraphed in advance like that, and it literally just would come out of nowhere. That's a great move, but I'll tell you what, I'm going to go with a much simpler choice here. Now, there's a lot of finishing moves over the years that I like. The Stunner, of course, got over very well, and I've always been a fan of Bret Hart's sharpshooter. Going back to the days of putting my little brother in the hold, and I can tell you that it is a legitimately painful hold if applied the right way. So is a figure four leg lock, by the way. When you feel bone on bone rubbing up against each other, if applied properly and for real, the figure four leg lock is one of the most painful holds you can ever find yourself in. But I'm going to go with the power bomb. Whether it was the jackknife power bomb from Diesel or the power bomb from Sid or any other number of wrestlers over the years. And I know it doesn't sound like it's not a finisher per se for a lot of people, but I've always loved the power bomb, especially when you have a big, tall guy lifting the guy up and just tossing them down to the canvas. I'm not necessarily a fan of the reckless way that Kevin Nash would do the power bomb. He legitimately hurt a lot of people with that move. He ended Danny Spivey's career when he was in WWF in '95 with the Waylon Mercy character. Character that had a lot of hope and a lot of promise. And unfortunately, Waylon Mercy, and at that point, Danny Spivey was beyond his physical prime anyway. But it was a match on Superstars in 1995. Diesel was the champion at the time, and he had a match with Waylon Mercy, and he got counted out. I think he was feuding with the British Bulldog at the time, and maybe the Bulldog came out for a distraction. Anyway, Diesel got counted out, came back into the ring, and, you can find the clip on YouTube. It doesn't look any worse or better than any other powerbomb. It doesn't look like a botch. And then maybe it wasn't. Maybe it was just a freak thing that occurred. But it was on that powerbomb that Diesel delivered to Waylon Mercy that Mercy's career came to an end. And, of course, the time in WCW might have been at a sold-out pay-per-view when Kevin Nash executed the jackknife on the Giant and almost killed the guy. He almost killed the Giant. Almost broke his neck. And there were a couple of other examples as well, but still, even recklessly so, there was something visually cool about watching somebody deliver the powerbomb. And I've always been very partial to it. It's probably one of my favorite finishing maneuvers, of all time. in wrestling. Seems very basic, and you don't see too many power bombs anymore. I mean, we saw Randy Orton use it back before the TLC pay-per-view. He was power bombing Alex Riley week after week as they were building up to his match with The Miz. But, you know, again, it's kind of like Shawn Michaels in that Indian Deathlock submission that he was doing for a while. He only adopted that move in advance of his match with Ric Flair at WrestleMania to prove that he had a submission that he was going to use in his match with Flair. So with Orton, it's like, well, we have this pay-per-view coming up, and the only way to win is to put somebody through a table, so let's just have Randy start doing power bombs. It's not the sort of thing I think you're going to see Randy Orton do much anymore. And it's a shame, because it's a cool-looking move, and we don't see too many power bombs anymore, but we don't see pile drivers either, and that's another cool-looking move. James writes in, Dear Solo Monster, if you were in charge of WWE, would you introduce a limit to the salary a wrestler could earn, essentially a salary cap? I say this because I've heard that John Cena and Triple H each earn in excess of $1 million annually, which I think is ridiculous, as there is better talent than them. For example, Daniel Bryan and Christian, whom I think that their talent is being wasted. I know that some talent wouldn't be happy, however, I believe it is unfair to the lesser paid talent. Also, if you were in charge, would you bring back the Cruiserweight division? I would not bring back the Cruiserweight division. I would bring in Cruiserweights, but you don't need a division with another title. We have enough titles. Now, I want to correct you on something that you said here. You talk about a salary cap. I am in favor of a salary cap in professional sports because I think the salaries that some of these people command, as talented as they may be, is absolutely out of control. Absolutely out of control. That goes for Major League Baseball, that goes for the NBA, that goes for the NFL. There is no one person, I don't care how talented you are, that is worth a five-year contract, for example, worth $140 million. You just cannot convince me that there is any one person worth that much money in sports. So I am in favor of a salary cap in sports. That's just me. When it comes to wrestling, it's a little bit different. I say in pro wrestling, you earn as much money as you can make. And the fact that you would argue that it's unfair that Triple H and John Cena make $1 million or more, if in fact they do, this doesn't mean that John Cena makes $1 million salary. So what you've probably heard is that John Cena earned $1 million or more last year, which would be accurate. But I think most of that money would be from merchandise sales, because Cena is the top seller in the company. Now, Triple H, on the other hand, for all I know, he is pulling in $1 million, and I think we all know why. But then again, he's also taking on greater responsibilities behind the scenes. He's going to be running the company soon. So why not? The point is, you say that it's unfair because Daniel Bryan or Christian should be making that kind of money because they're a better talent. That is the most absurd, ridiculous argument I have ever heard in my life. It's a ridiculous argument. Not that Daniel Bryan and Christian are better in-ring wrestlers than John Cena. I believe they are. But by no means should they be making $1 million over John Cena. What money has Daniel Bryan or Christian brought into WWE? And I'm as big a Daniel Bryan supporter as you're going to find here, but let's be honest. Let's be fair about this. Neither one of those guys deserves to be making anywhere close to $1 million. Talk to me in 5 years, maybe Daniel Bryan will be at that level. Christian, if he's not already there, probably isn't going to be. You can't base someone's salary on the fact that they're a better in-ring wrestler, which is it's a subjective thing in and of itself. The guys who make money for the company and who sell the most merchandise and move the most tickets should be making the most money. And Daniel Bryan and Christian ain't those guys. So that's a stupid argument. I mean, come on, you're a smart guy. I've gotten emails from you before. You can't honestly believe that. So let's put things in perspective here. They're great, great wrestlers. I will support them until I turn blue in the face. But your argument doesn't hold any water here. And you can make an argument about Triple H and whether or not he deserves that. But a guy like a John Cena or a Randy Orton, they're the top guys in the company. Like it or not, they are the top guys. Is it fair that they're always constantly in all the pay-per-view main events and getting the big pay-per-view bonuses? Now, you can make an argument that that's not fair. But they make the money that they make because they deserve it. If they can make that kind of money, God bless them. If they could sell that many t-shirts and armbands and everything else, God bless them. Daniel Bryan and Christian are not at that level. If they can make that kind of money for the company and sell a bunch of t-shirts, then they deserve it. But they don't. So that's why they don't make that kind of money. End of story. So two more here. John writes into the Sound Off from Manchester, England. Hey, Solomonster, is it true that Psycho Sid shit himself during his WrestleMania 13 match with The Undertaker? If it is, I wonder what Taker thought when he lifted Sid up for the tombstone. I've heard this before, and I'm pretty sure it's an urban legend, even though there are people that will swear by it being true. I have not ever heard any sort of confirmation from Undertaker or Sid or anybody with any sort of real authority that it was true. It's possible, but I'm fairly certain it was an urban legend. On the other hand, there is a story that I think has been verified, or you know, people have said that it's accurate, years ago of Andre the Giant shitting during a match in the ring. This might have been, I don't know if it was in Mexico, maybe. Maybe it was in Mexico, but Andre was not feeling too well and had a stomach virus, and Andre did this spot in some of his matches where he would sit on his opponent's face in the corner up against the turnbuckle, like the lower turnbuckle. It might have been a six-man tag. Anyway, Andre and Bad News Brown were in the match, and I think Andre did that to Bad News Brown, and he had shit himself. And Bad News Brown rolled out of the ring and was throwing up all over the place, and pretty nasty stuff. So it's been known to happen before, but as far as at WrestleMania, the Sid story, I chalk it up to an urban legend. And lastly here, this comes from Antonio in the Bronx. Go Jets. Solomonster, just wanted to give you and the team at SC Scoops credit for something I have not heard or seen promoted on the site, and that is the mobile version of the SC Scoops website. What an excellent site. Mobile sites like ESPN and UFC could learn something from SC Scoops Mobile. Well, I appreciate that, and you can give credit to that to Webmaster Mike. I know people have written in weeks past and complained that the mobile site wasn't working for them, and that's because it was being worked on. I'm not sure if it's completed yet and everything's all cool, or if there's still some maintenance going on, but definitely check out SC Scoops Mobile if you have not already done so, and if it's not already retooled, it will be shortly. So thank you to Antonio for that, and if you have questions, you can go to SC Scoops Mobile and find a link to the Solomonster. Email me at thesolomonster@gmail.com. You can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/Solomonster. And, of course, the beloved Facebook page, facebook.com/TheSolomonster. Get on there now. We're over 550 friends and counting. I want to count you among them. And subscribe to The Sound Off in iTunes if you have not already done so, because it'll just make your life so much easier. Why wouldn't you want that? Episode 143 coming up next weekend. Till next time, be well, stay safe, keep spreading the good word of the Sound Off. We'll see you right back here next week. Take it easy, guys.
Let me tell you something, fella.
This is Joe from Northern Ireland.
Hi, I'm AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solomonster Sounds Off on SEScoops.com.